Well, bonjour tout le monde. Hello everyone. So I welcome you to the last event of Media and Guild this year. As some of you know, the theme for this year was Media, War and Conflict. And so it would be extremely fitting to finish it with music. But of course, the angle of music is not something that we're actually used to, but that is going to be discussed here today, but a very present reality. And so we're very pleased to have Susan Fusick with us today. Jonathan Stern, my colleague, is going to introduce her. But I just wanted to mention a few things about Media at McGill. So as you know, Media at McGill is a center of interdisciplinary center. Who mainly do research on the relationship between media, culture, and technology. And so this year, as I mentioned, was war, media war and conflict, and next year our theme is going to be participatory media. Okay, so I just wanted to start to announce what we're doing next year. So without further ado, I'm just going to very briefly introduce you Jonathan, who teaches in the Department of Art History and Communication Studies at McGill University. He's also part of the teachers in the History and Philosophy of Science program at McGill. He is the author of MP3, The Meaning of a Format, and The Audible Past, Cultural Origins of Sound Reproduction, and the author of numerous articles on media, technologies, and the politics of culture. He is finally the editor of the important compilation, which is entitled The Sound Studies Reader, published recently in 2012. So, Jonathan, can you introduce us?
Thank you. I'll be brief. First, the who, then the why. Suzanne Cusick is a professor of music on the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at New York University. She's published extensively on gender and sexuality in relation to the musical cultures of early modern Italy and of contemporary North America, including collections like Musicology and Difference, Queering the Pitch, and Audible Traces. She's famous for her feminist readings of early modern music and musical culture. They've appeared in all the important musicology journals. Since 2003, she's edited Women in Music, a Journal of Gender and Culture, the first journal, and I think still the only English-language journal focused on the relationship of gender and sexuality to musical culture. Currently, she studies the interrogation of prisoners held during the 21st century's War on Terror, work for which she's received the Philip Rudd Award given by the LGBTQ Study Group of the American Musicological Society in 2007. Now, I first encountered her work in this book, Queering the Pitch, in 1994, her very also famous essay on the lesbian relation music. And there's just a couple quotes in there that there's a sort of through line that the first line of the essay that's not in Italian, i.e. the first line that I could read, says, and I quote, "I have a great fear. I am very afraid, and they're not quite the same." The origin of this essay was in two moments of shock, a shock of non-recognition and one of recognition. So what you're going to hear today is a very different kind of shock of non-recognition, and it actually, I think, comes from a presupposition in most musicological thought, and even in Zen's prior work, that the study of music is somehow connected to the love of music, and that the love of music is connected to things that we generally see as social and cultural goods, right? So in this essay, she says, "I teach music as the lover, the active force which generates pleasure, which leads one body and soul into an alternate reality, into intimacy." Now imagine what happens when that gets twisted around in the U.S. military's no-touch torture program. I actually had the pleasure of seeing a paper delivered in Professor Cusick's absence at Cambridge University. It was amazing. I've actually never seen a paper given in the absence of the author where the audience then freaked out. It was incredible. And so I'm not asking that you freak out today, but I expect that what we will hear from Professor Cusick will be equally at least challenging and forceful and probably quite uncomfortable. And for that, if the topic is not happy, at least the occasion is.
Wow, thank you very much for, you can hear me all right? As I thank Professor Stern for that surprising shock of recognition and non-recognition kind of introduction. SpongeBob is here for a purpose, believe it or not, actually for several purposes. One purpose is to give you hope that midway through the talk, you will actually see this clip from the SpongeBob movie. It's pertinent. The use of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques is back in the news in the United States, enjoying, if that's the right word, a wave of temporary fashionability because of a series of unrelated events. The release, in December 2012, of Catherine Bigelow's film Zero Dark Thirty, which many viewers interpret as affirming the utility of such techniques to the eventual assassination of Osama bin Laden in 2011. The ongoing popularity of the premium cable TV series Homeland, a melodramatic fiction depicting the entwined fates of a bipolar woman CIA operative and the Al-Qaeda sleeper terrorist whose mission she seeks to thwart. The non-release of a 6,000-page report to the U.S. Senate's Select Committee on Intelligence, which is said to describe in exhaustive detail the CIA's elaborate global system of detention, rendition, enhanced interrogation, and torture. The 216-page report, Globalizing Torture, Secret Detention and Extraordinary Rendition, released in the U.S. by the Open Society Justice Initiative just a few weeks ago. An extended review essay of recent academic literature on torture in the progressive weekly magazine, The Nation. A flurry of publicity sparked by the appointment of Enhanced Interrogation's former supervisor, John Brennan, to head the CIA, and the imminent appointment as head of the clandestine services of the woman who executed the order to destroy interrogation videotapes. And the UN's special rapporteur on human rights and counterterrorism's official request that the US and the UK release their confidential investigations into CIA detention and interrogation practices during the George W. Bush administration. It would seem, then, that this could be a breakthrough moment, one in which scholarly discussions, among other things like the one that you've been having this year at McGill, could help fuel some kind of activism that would object effectively to the whole spectrum of enhanced interrogation techniques, including the acoustical ones. But I fear it is not such a moment, because we have seen moments like this before in U.S. public life. Indeed, such moments have come like waves in the 9 years since the Abu Ghraib photos first circulated. Always, the energy of the wave has dissipated. Always, public conversation has developed from the moral to the practical. Always, the sheer sameness of the turns the public conversation takes has transformed harrowing reality into boring banality, and finally, actually quite quickly, into silence. My paper today explores the silencing forces that converge to produce a censorship effect that, although, or perhaps because, it has no one institutional source, has been remarkably successful in stifling public debate. But first, and as the context against which I will probe the censorship effect, I want to review what we who have studied the use of music in enhanced interrogation think we know. A survey of all the published material on this practice over the last decade reveals a consensus that music and other sounds played at high volumes through various playback systems became a very widely diffused practice by which U.S. authorities and their surrogates responded to non-compliant prisoners. So-called loud music was used to suppress detainees' ability to talk to each other, to interfere acoustically with calls to prayer that were being broadcast simultaneously with the loud music through the camp's public address systems, to punish prisoners who objected to aspects of their own or their fellow prisoners' treatment, and as components of interrogation plans that used a range of enhanced interrogation techniques to induce prisoners believed to have high-value intelligence to tell what they knew. Those special interrogation plans all had to be approved minimally by the camp commanding officer, but most of them were actually approved at the level of the Secretary of Defense during the height of the Iraq War. This range of practices can be documented across the archipelago of secret prisons operated by the CIA and its contractors. The archipelago of official prisons operated by the U.S. Department of Defense, which is a different archipelago, its uniformed personnel and its contractors. I do not personally know, but I assume that similar practices may also have been used in the prisons of other nations to which U.S. prisoners have been more or less clandestinely consigned through the program known as Extraordinary Rendition. Most of the available documentation suggests strongly that, widely diffused as this set of practices is, all its variants have common roots in CIA practices that were theorized in the 1940s and 50s by state-sponsored research in North American universities. And I'm particularly interested to be reading this paper at McGill because McGill was the most prominent among those universities. U.S. uniformed personnel, who, if captured, were likely to be perceived as having high-value intelligence, were taught to resist these and other techniques of enhanced interrogation in special training schools known by the acronym SERE, S-E-R-E, which stands for Survive, Evade, Resist, and Escape. Veterans either of the CIA or of SEER training are thought to have introduced these techniques to standard U.S. interrogations during the War on Terror, acting on orders from the U.S. President, the Vice President, the Secretary of Defense, and the Director of Central Intelligence, all of whom have admitted to giving these orders. The music program, as some have called it, was always understood by interrogators as one of a set of techniques intended to break down a prisoner's subjectivity quickly and efficiently. In an article published about 2 weeks ago, based on the paper that Professor Stern heard someone else read, I analyzed the recollections of some released prisoners to show how they experienced the music to work. The men I interviewed described the music as seemingly calculated to produce temporal disorientation, to deny them the ability to concentrate that might have allowed them to forget the bodily pain produced by stress positions, thirst, and cold, to leave the physical effect of having been beaten, and indeed, so to prevent them from sustaining their own thoughts that they found themselves singing along, even when, as one man put it, he was singing along with a sound mix he described as not music music. He and one other man described this singing along as feeling like their selves' very destruction, a particularly painful, exaggerated version, perhaps, of the experience of being spoken by discourse. That was also, of course, a useful prelude to interrogations in which these men needed to speak the words of their interrogator's desire. What I have just told you, however, is not the narrative that circulates among the general population in the United States. Little of the detail I just gave you has broken through, for a variety of reasons that probably have as much to do with the public narrative about enhanced interrogation as with public opinions about music. Public discussion about enhanced interrogation generally has come to be dominated by journalist Jane Mayer's 2008 book, The Dark Side, which represents the U.S.'s recourse to torture and systematic prisoner abuse as an artifact of the Bush-Cheney-Rumsfeld team's panicky, ill-conceived response to the September 2001 attacks, and thus as an exception to the U.S.'s high-minded tradition of rejecting torture. While Mayer's account is superbly researched as far as it goes, the narrative arc that represents U.S. torture as, so to speak, a dark side exception to the U.S.'s self-proclaimed exceptionalism is so persuasively contradicted by the even more well-documented research of Alfred McCoy, Michael Otterman, Darius Rajali, and Lala Khalili, that it cannot logically be taken to be true. Yet its persistence, so flattering to the U.S.'s self-image, channels public discussion toward questions of emergency, specifically toward what we, who think we are intrinsically innocent, and, as Americans, exceptional for our moral virtue and democratic values, what we should do in moments of national emergency. What, we ask each other, would we do if faced with a ticking time bomb scenario? Or, we ask, in response to Zero Dark 30, what if torture is what really worked to enable us to get Osama bin Laden? Or, most recently, we ask each other which is preferable, the infinite detention and, it seems, systematic abuse of people whom the state believes to be threatening, or their annihilation by drones. We do not ask ourselves very often why we think that some lives are more valuable than others, much less what might motivate those others. Instead, we cling to narratives and to modes of public debate that consistently portray the people we imprison as profoundly, frighteningly other. This assumption manifests itself in relation to music in the recurrence of certain tropes when the music of detention is mentioned, something that is in itself relatively rare. Three tropes stand out. First, there is the idea that music torture amounts to the continuous looping of particular songs, a claim that is both corroborated and not by interrogators' published memoirs and released prisoners' accounts. It is sometimes true that repetition produced the devastating effects, but only sometimes. Second, there is the idea that the lyrics of particular songs were chosen for their delivery of offensive messages, especially if those messages offended Muslims' presumed sexual reticence. Again, it is a claim that is both corroborated and not, a claim that oversimplifies based on the wide distribution of one man's interrogation log in 2006. And third, there are the entangled ideas that music intrinsically offends Muslims, both in itself and because particular styles that are most widely reported, metal, rap, and country, are all said to offend, bedazzle, and ultimately harm the prisoners because they are so unfamiliar. Not coincidentally, these genres are abject to the chattering classes who circulate these tropes because they're associated with the U.S.'s suburban, urban, and rural poor, respectively. This third claim, insofar as it is made about prisoners who are specific targets of the music program as part of their interrogations, is probably not true, because those men seem all to have been high-value detainees and all to have had significant experience living in the West or in westernized circumstances. All of them. These tropes imply an imagining of the prisoners as culturally other in their inability to cope with Western ideas as they are embedded in Western music or with Western music itself. In effect, the prisoners are portrayed as vulnerable to the music program because they aren't properly musical. When these tropes circulate with the Mayer narrative of enhanced interrogation techniques as constituting an exception to American exceptionalism, they amalgamate into an American self-image that can, via Mayer, disavow the U.S.'s long history of intentional psychological abuse, that implies an imagined self-other boundary that is classed in terms of domestic concerns and raced, that is, Islamicized, in terms of international ones, and that, in the assumption behind the continuous loop trope that repetition equals torture, provides Americans with a weird kind of alibi for why we don't want to keep hearing these stories. If repetition equals torture, then the repetition in public discussion of the same claims and counterclaims, the same tropes of discussion, can begin to feel like it is torturing us. Alternatively, the repetitiousness of our public debate can be said to constitute something like a repetition compulsion, like the traumatized Tancredi, we can't let go of our collective guilt, but continue to seek a fantasy Clorinda who will forgive us. Moreover, when taken together, these tropes about the music program obfuscate, if they don't obliterate entirely, what those targeted men say themselves about their experience. They say, overwhelmingly, that the music produces temporal disorientation. They say, too, that it denies them interiority, in that it denies them a mental space in which they can think their own thoughts, and from which they can speak their own thoughts, independent of their captor's desires. And they say that the music is not only a medium of psychological torture. It delivers a physical beating, they say, that leaves no marks on the body's surfaces because the beating is delivered in their own flesh and bones through the principle of sympathetic vibration. I think the distinction between what most Americans tell ourselves and what the released prisoners say is crucial. So let me say what I think it is. Whereas the tropes that circulate in popular culture focus on either repetition or on music's capacity to deliver culturally offensive messages through lyrics or sonic style, that is, on music as a medium for representation, the released detainees' accounts focus on an experience of music that is outside representation, though it is saturated with meaning. The released detainees' experience thus points directly to an epistemological dilemma that bedevils musicology in the relation of representation to meaning and the relation of either representation or meaning to what one could take for truth. Because we share it with the vast majority of our compatriots, this epistemological dilemma about how music works, what it is, how it can be said to mean or to do things in the world contributes to our professional inability to break through a censorship effect. The second part of my talk today traces the censorship effect that I believe operates in contemporary American life. I will start with my own experience. I have to confess that by sometime in the 2009-2010 academic year, I found myself overwhelmed by personal grief. The affective pressure of reading empathetically about pain, physical or psychic, and or of reading about the objectifying, dispassionate cruelty of the researchers, commanders, legal and political apologists for these practices had become nearly unbearable, as did a sense of responsibility to continue speaking out when I had come to think that there was little that either public or academic speech could do. A kind of breaking point came for me in the fall of 2010, after I had spent a harrowing but oddly relieving summer bearing no other responsibility than caring for a partner who was recovering from surgery for a life-threatening illness. I was on sabbatical in the fall of 2010 and went to Italy, as much to recover as to do research. Still, it must be said that when I arrived there, I fully intended to use Italy, as I had the previous summer, as a base of operations from which to deepen my connections with released detainees around Europe and the Mediterranean. One afternoon, as I sat on a park bench in Florence, reading Steve Goodman's 2010 book, Sonic Warfare, I realized that I just didn't want to feel that way anymore. I didn't want to fill my imagination and my affective world with the ideas and practices that his narrative engaged, nor did I want to feel as if I were constantly crying without tears inwardly, as I so often do when I think about what the U.S. had done. I closed the book, crossed the river, and walked to the Archivi di Stato to begin following up on a completely different project about sex and singing nuns in 1620s Florence, a project in which I had dabbled before. The result of that choice, I should add, might well be a metonym for the consequences of my countrymen's similar feelings, that they just didn't want to feel that way anymore. Because the project about sex and singing nuns has required me to read several thousand pages of ecclesiastical and civil investigation. Naturally, ecclesiastical investigation, and in fact civil investigation in 1620, includes torture and the almost ubiquitous threat of torture. The transcripts of these investigations record, too, torrents of threatening speech by which an interrogator called in Italian inquisitore bullied nuns into responding with compliant speech that touched all the eroticized tropes of broken womanhood, tears, prayers, and simultaneously sexual ignorance and sexual licentiousness. Eroticized compliant speech that was also demonstrably false based on the documents in the trial record. Though they knew it was false, the interrogators presented it to the authorities as, in their words, verosimile, verisimilar, plausible, lifelike, because it better served the self-interest and the self-narrative of the Tuscan state than did the truth. I sat there one day in the archive, just like this, and realized I had read this story before. I knew then, and I know now, that there is to be no escape from feeling that way. And so I'm sure it will yet be for my countrymen. My desire to escape feeling that way was not without political, professional, and indeed mediatic contexts, of course. And those contexts are ultimately more important than my personal feelings. One important political context was the pervasive imperative many progressive Americans had felt since 2009 to let the new president have his chance. His chance to close Guantanamo and other limbo-like detention centers around the world for which it has become a symbol. And his chance to repudiate the policies, the practices, and the perpetrators of enhanced interrogation, whether by shunning the perpetrators or, preferably, by bringing them to justice before national and international law. Yet by the summer of 2010, it was clear, one, that Guantanamo would remain open. Two, that President Obama's apparently bold proclamations that the United States does not torture were minutely calibrated to leave loopholes for non-uniformed contract employees and for other governments to do exactly that in the service of U.S. intelligence gathering. And three, that the Obama administration's Justice Department would quash most of its own investigations, and in the few it had pursued, decide to chastise the justifying attorneys for intentional professional misconduct, but to prosecute or discipline no one. Absolutely no one, least of all the former president, vice president, and defense secretary who periodically and proudly go on TV to admit that they have authorized torture. But the same administration vigorously prosecuted torture whistleblower John Kiriakou, who was profiled in last week's New Yorker, because last month he began serving a 30-month prison term for inadvertently revealing the identity of another CIA officer. And that same administration has detained Private Bradley Manning for 3 years, including 9 months in isolation without his clothes on, for releasing tens of thousands of documents to WikiLeaks, documents that have proven enormously useful to scholars of the Bush-Cheney wars. In short, the best that can be said about the Obama administration's record on what its documents now call enhanced interrogation techniques is that it has conferred a de facto impunity on both the architects and the agents of a whole system of torture. Their impunity is ostensibly the price to be paid for moving on. The worst that can be said is that this administration has successfully delayed, obfuscated, and suppressed public debate about that system. While it has, according to the report Globalizing Torture that I cited earlier, released last month, continued to practice the rendition of prisoners to other countries whose security forces conduct interrogations on the U.S.'s behalf, continued to operate its own detention and interrogation sites in theater, that is, in Afghanistan and aboard U.S. Navy ships, and recently narrowed the list of questionable interrogation practices that it means to avoid to nudity, cold, sleep deprivation, stress positions, wall slamming, and waterboarding. You'd think that that's enough, but absent from this list, along with the music program, are such sensory, psychological, and spiritual disruptions to subjectivity as hooding, manipulation of darkness and light, gender coercion, and interference with the detainees' prayer practices, all of which qualify as abusive treatment under the terms of the Convention Against Torture, but which fall into this subcategory of psychological abuse, a category of actions to which the U.S. reserved its right when it ratified the Convention Against Torture in 1994. This record is, to say the least, dispiriting. It implies that any real change in U.S. practice will require much more profound political and moral pressure than anything that has so far been attempted. Trying to figure out how best to be helpful in that effort is not easy, in no small part because, it seems to me, there is some new field on which power is being wielded, some new field that remains opaque to me. So insofar as I had hoped my research could have some political impact on my countrymen's consciousness and consciences, I am temporarily stumped. It is not surprising that in an environment of denial, disavowal, and dispiriting disinformation, such public debate about torture as exists would have been taking place in the cultural space known casually as entertainment media, a cultural space about which I have, as a musicologist, only limited knowledge. I am, after all, a specialist in the music of the dead. And I don't mean the grateful. Both physical torture and its ghostly euphemistic twin, enhanced interrogation, have been repeatedly justified in episodes of the widely popular television series 24, and I'm told that they have been sympathetically represented in such series as Alias and Lost, though I have not personally watched either one. Isolated episodes of series that I do watch on occasion, producer Dick Wolf's Law and Order franchise, Donald Belisario's NCIS franchise, and the series Criminal Minds, Burn Notice, and The Good Wife, have all staged critiques of some aspects of CIA detention and interrogation practices. In a way, the entirety of the 7-season vehicle for Kara Sedgwick, known as The Closer, staged such a critique. All of these shows provoked live and virtual discussion about torture, mostly turning on the two questions I articulated at the outset. Does torture work? And what if there were a ticking time bomb scenario? I fear, however, that the regularity with which U.S. audiences are exposed to images of U.S. citizens torturing others has actually deadened debate. I fear, that is, that familiarity has begun to breed boredom with the whole subject, even when it erupts as real, as news, from very similar screens. Indeed, the website of Physicians for Human Rights reports right now that as of this year, 41% of U.S. residents agree with the statement, the U.S. should torture prisoners captured in the fight against terrorism. I cannot pretend to have watched all the relevant televisual fictions of the torture debate, though I look forward to sabbatical. But from the research that I have done, it seems that the use of music to torture or harshly interrogate is hardly ever represented in the entertainments media corporations produce as small and big screen entertainment. One early exception is, of all things, this relatively lighthearted scene from the 2004 SpongeBob movie, which depicts the torturers as obvious bad guy metalheads with some anxieties about music in relation to their idea of mature masculinity. SpongeBob and his friend, the starfish Patrick, have gone to the men's room in a bar, a biker bar, and are playing bubbles.
Hey! Who blew this bubble? You all know the rules.
All the blowing babies will be beaten senseless by every able-bodied patron in the bar.
That's right! So who blew it? So, nobody knows.
Maybe it was...
Shut up! Somebody in here ain't a real man. You! We're on a baby hunt, and don't think we don't know how to weed them out. Now everybody line up. DJ, time for the test. No baby can resist singing along to this.
SpongeBob, it's the Goofy Goober theme song.
I know.
Oh, hi, Goofy Goober, yeah. You're a Goofy Goober, yeah. We're all Goofy Goobers, yeah. Goofy Goofy Goober Goober, yeah.
It was you! You're the baby!
No, no! I only coughed, I swear!
DJ, turn it up louder!
You're a Goofy Goober,
don't sing along, Patrick!
I'm trying! Trying so hard!
I'm a Goofy Goober, yeah! You're a Goofy Goober, yeah! We're all Goofy Goobers, yeah!
Yeah! So that's one piece of comic relief. I, for one, am fascinated that this scene could have been included in a film released very soon after the shocking revelations of Abu Ghraib focused everyone's attention on the notion of U.S. torture practices, and at a time when almost no one knew that music was being used. I have no idea how they did it. The other thing I want to say, though, about this clip is that the first time I watched the SpongeBob movie with my then 5-year-old nephew, Declan Lanyi, I watched it 6 times because I was watching it with a 5-year-old. Declan watched it 6 times, too. He has probably watched it 200 times since because he loved that movie. And so what has that done to his subjectivity and his idea of what are acceptable practices, I don't know. Interestingly, representations linking music and torture are more easily found on the internet. And where they are found, it's mainly as a comic topos. And so I want to give you another bit of comic relief.
Hi there, welcome to Red Straight Update. My name's Jackie Rowe.
And I'm done laughing. A lot of liberal musicians are upset because they think their songs were used to torture prisoners at Guantanamo. Yeah. Listen, if R.E.M. didn't want their music to be tortured, they shouldn't have recorded Shiny Happy People.
Hell, music ain't torture.
Have you heard Bob Dylan's Christmas album?
I mean, all these musicians need to shut the hell up. They need to shut the damn mouths up. Hell, we pulled out a drill to torture a lot of them terrorists down there. But you don't see Black and Decker going up to Washington complaining, do you?
I can see how some of these songs might drive people like insane, might be over the line a little bit, like that Meow Mix commercial. Supposedly they played that at them prisoners.
What? Meow Mix commercial? That's adorable. Yeah. How is that torture them terrorists? That Meow Mix, all them little kitty cats saying, that's sweet as can be. What are you talking about?
You like it so much, how would you like it pumped out at your face high decibel for 20 weeks?
Oh,
here, take a listen to it. I got it on here.
Wait, you got the Meow Mix commercial on here?
Yeah, I made a Torture Jams playlist. Put it on.
I'll put that on for you.
Torture? They haven't been tortured until they've heard Red State Update. How freedom sounds.
Now, I'll stop it there because I actually have have too much more to say. But one, this and some other clips that I have found on the internet at YouTube use humor quite effectively to critique torture. But at the same time that this video is using humor effectively to critique torture, music torture in particular, like the SpongeBob movie, it engages in the class and partisan-based disavowal that created the space for the Obama administration's obfuscation. Turning to the professional, I have found my own research as activism agenda stymied by two aspects of professional disciplining that contribute to my experience of a censorship effect. One of them is something I cannot speak about today. I cannot speak on the video record of this event to which I have agreed about it. High technology and a fondness for easily distributed media can have their own censoring effects, it seems. Suffice to say that institutional pressures converge to prevent me from pursuing aspects of this subject that most interest me until I retire, which is an incentive to retire. In the meantime, I struggle with another complex of notions, questions, and thoughts that I've experienced as exerting a censorship effect, and that is the disciplining pressure that is associated with professional musicology. For however welcome scholarship about the acoustical regimes of U.S. detention camps may be here, it does not strike many people in the United States as really musicology. My first experience of this response was to my very first quite ragged and speculative paper on the subject. A graduate student at Cornell excoriated me for daring to talk about politics in what had been billed as a musicology lecture. I didn't quite get what he was driving at, beyond quite accurately calling me naive, until over a year later, when I was lunching with colleagues at Harvard's Charles Warren Center for Studies in American History. A well-known art historian launched the lunch conversation by saying that he wanted me to talk about the music, specifically, just the music. Tell me what I expect a musicologist to say. Since that conversation, I've read blog and listserv discussions of my work that cited various qualities, ranging from the nature of my sources to the nature of my argument, as evidence that this is not musicology. And when I've been invited to speak at other universities, I've been specifically asked, please don't talk about torture. Please bring us something that is musicology. This thwarted me because I had intended to use all such invitations to speak about torture to as many people as possible. What, I wondered, could musicology possibly be if it was not scholarly thought about a contemporary musical practice? But the response I made to my art history colleague several years ago remains the most intellectually responsible one I can give, at least based on my research. Military officers who have commanded sonic bombardment, PSYOPs officers who have overseen it, former interrogators who have provided autobiographical accounts of their own acoustical interrogation practices, and released detainees all agree with the statement made to St. Petersburg Times reporter Lane DeGregory in 2004. At some level, a PSYOPs officer said to him, it's not so much the music as the sound. Released detainee Raul Ahmed, in fact, has said in video interviews posted on YouTube that there would be a point in his experience of the music program when music would stop seeming like music to him, but would come to seem like disorganized metallic banging. And I think the makers of the Meow Mix clip actually must have read that, because they eventually introduced sonic distortion. Another released detainee noted to me privately both that the music in Afghanistan's dark prison was not, in his words, music, so much as it was a set of sounds that seemed to him and other prisoners there to be on a tape that was continuously replayed. The same man also noted that at Guantanamo, where the delivery of sound was both much more focused because of specially designed speakers and much louder, The effect was as much physical as it was psychological. He said to me, "You feel like you've been beaten by a hammer. Din, 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 din." In light of these men's comments, I think I cannot talk about the music specifically, as my art history colleague and my colleagues in U.S. musicology departments have asked me to. The absolute inseparability of these men's aural experiences from function, location and space and place, bodily situation, from, that is, context, is the biggest challenge to traditional musicological thinking about this practice. That's the beauty of it from the torturer's point of view. That's what makes it hard to represent, hard to analyze, and therefore hard even to imagine forcefully enough to sustain a reasoned argument opposing it. But it's also the beauty of it from the point of view of musicologists looking for a test case for what something like a post-musicology might be. Because the way the U.S. has used music in detention in this century is a phenomenon completely saturated with meaning, as well as resonant with histories of musical and acoustical violence in military and detention. But that is also simultaneously a limit case for the experiential mode musicologist Carolyn Abate called, in 2004, the drastic. Moreover, the drastic experience that the two men I quoted above describe is one in which the imaginary boundary between music and sound irreparably bursts. To put what I mean in a slightly different way, the use of music in enhanced interrogation, in detention, is a practice that has quantumized the imaginary, or perhaps I mean the conceptual, solidity denoted by the word music in enlightened imperial Europe and in its self-proclaimed successor, the imperial United States. That conceptual solidity condensed certain sonic practices of human beings so that they could be experienced as representation and its cousin, expressive practice, and therefore as objects of aesthetic activity, including the contemplation and analysis that remains the most common work associated with musicology. I fear we are still pretty far away from theorizing a musicology that could address the experiences of which Raul Ahmed and other released prisoners speak. And that lapse in my discipline's theorizing itself contributes to the censorship effect. Both music torture's unrepresentability and sonic play with unpredictability characterize the recent film Zero Dark Thirty, which has reopened public discussion about enhanced interrogation and channeled that discussion toward one of the familiar tropes, but does torture work? The film opens in silence. And forgive me for the clumsiness of my clips. Followed by a sound collage of 9/11 cell phone calls. Cuts to a noisy interrogation scene, shouted abuse, clanging doors as people enter and leave. Then, after a brief interruption, the shouts, cries, grunts, and gurgles of waterboarding.
Azam was a friend of Ramzi Youssef. You guys met in Iran back in the 90s.
I don't know! Fuck you!
The emails of the rest of the Saudi group. Give me one email and I will stop this. Who's in the Saudi group? What's the target? Where was the last time you saw Bin Laden? Where was the last time you saw Bin Laden, huh? You know, when you lie to me, I hurt you.
Then, oh, this is so cool. About 7 minutes later, after scenes that established the main character's position in her new CIA posting, a very brief shot of hooded, orange-suited men cuts to a scene of music torture, shot from behind. There you have it, the longest representation of music torture that exists, as far as I know, in the media. The longest, 14 seconds. And of course, there are reasons for that. The very brief representation of what is, practically speaking, unrepresentable is by no means the only moment of sonic violence in the film. In fact, it is full of sonic violence. A narrative arc from the telephonic sonic chaos of 9/11 to eventual resolution in heroic, triumphant music of revenge. Frequently interrupted by moments of extreme sonic violence, diegetic machine gun fire, and explosions. At first unpredictable, these interruptions eventually fall into a pattern. Both diegetic sonic violence and sonic chaos is consistently assigned to the actions of real or presumed terrorists, disrupting non-diegetic point of view music or diegetic quiet. By contrast, non-diegetic music communicates the foreboding, piqued interest, grief, or heroism of the CIA team. This pattern breaks definitively only in a long scene near the film's end that represents the raid on bin Laden's home in Abbottabad. By the end of the film, that is, sound has delineated a kind of boundary between us, who have music and emotions, and them, who have violence and chaos, that we cross only in proximity to them, a crossing that is marked by U.S. making noise, us making noise. In that sonic fiction, music that tortures could never be represented because music represents us, the civilized, reasonable, illegitimately violated U.S. who became violent only when provoked and whose violence resolves definitively into music once bin Laden is gone. We are back here to the tropes implying that musical torture works because the terrorists are intrinsically unmusical. Thus, I think the film's sound design contributes to the disavowal of music torture, even while very briefly representing it. Indeed, the disavowal works because of that brief representation of a sonic power dynamic that the film's sound design turns inside out. By functioning in the film's sound design, not as a means of torture, but as a medium of disavowal and self-justification, the music of Zero Dark Thirty contributes mightily to the film's censorship effect. There is more to be said about the sound design of Zero Dark Thirty in relation to its political function. Okay. Two aspects of it particularly intrigue me, and I'd like to close by noting them. First, there is the material of which the soundtrack is made. Like all soundtracks, this one draws from a wide range of carefully shaped... You know, actually, I printed out the wrong version. I think. No, I guess this is right. Like all soundtracks, this one draws from a wide range of carefully shaped sounds and bits of recorded music, so as to represent, for example, the gurgling, choking resistance of a man being waterboarded, the ambient sound of the Islamabad Marriott right before it blows up, and so forth, as well as non-diegetic music used very conventionally to establish the emotional standpoint of the CIA officers, Navy SEALs, and we who watch. Two additional features are notable, however. Whereas in the first half of the film, non-US actors speak English when they don't gurgle, scream, or groan, in the second half, non-US actors increasingly speak Arabic. Because it is incomprehensible, it takes on the quality of chatter. At one point, it is actually represented as just that, chatter on the internet. That is, of sonic chaos, so that it begins to resemble both the resisting gurgles and groans and the diegetic explosions and machine gun fire that mark terrorist acts. In a way, that is, terrorist speech is represented as on a continuum of noise that encompasses the sounds of terrorist action. This layer of intelligible speech is combined with another layer of speech that is always fully intelligible. It is a layer made up of electronically mediated voices from cell phones, television interviews, and videotaped interrogations. The latter, obviously mediated form of speech, lends the film its vaguely documentary feel. Thus, it supports the claim that the film is based on actual events, even though there are moments when a chapter title frame is needed to ensure that we interpret the actuality correctly. For example, the opening cell phone collage it retroactively interpreted as the real 9/11, as heard that day, forecloses the possibility that a viewer might remember that just such sound collages were played for Mohammed al-Qahtani during his extremely well-documented interrogation at Guantanamo in the winter of 2003. Yet if the documentary feeling linked to the film by electronically mediated voices authorizes the film's account, it also exposes the similarity of all mediated accounts. What we might think we know from CNN is no less mediated, after all, than what we might think we know from the film. If everything we know is electronically mediated hearsay, we have no way of distinguishing the verisimilar from the true. The second aspect of the film's design that intrigues me is its play with temporality. As I mentioned above, while the narrative arc from 9/11's sonic chaos to a post-Bin Laden resolution in music is strong, the path from start to finish has many twists and turns. The film's storyline is woven of three main strands, each with a sonic signature: office politics, CIA style, with predominantly diegetic sounds; representations of interrogations, also with predominantly diegetic sounds, occasionally enhanced by adumbrations of the film score's principal theme, which we just heard, when Maya hears important information; and third, representations of terrorist attacks, which are dominated by explosive sounds that disrupt everything. When I first saw the film in the theater, I felt these explosions of sonic chaos to be tremendously effective. They literally made me jump, physically in my seat, and psychically in terms of my identifications with characters and plot turns. They put me in mind of one of the first things released detainee Donald Vance had told me about the music program at Baghdad's Camp Cropper. Don noted that, in his words, the music jumped unpredictably among its three most common genres, metal, rap, and country. He eventually said that he thought the jumping was one of the most devastating effects, because it disrupted his ability either to concentrate on actively resisting the music's invasion of his head or on his ability to resist by letting it wash over him. Instead, it produced a constant conundrum from which he could not escape, and thus it was a perfect realization in sound, and by means of sound, of what the 2006 U.S. Army Field Manual for Interrogation calls the futility approach. Reminded of the futility approach, which is meant to persuade the target that resistance is futile, I left the theater wondering if Zero Dark Thirty's sound design could be said to have produced a similar effect. Because by the time the non-diegetic theme that I privately call the hunt for bin Laden music, which is what I just played for you, began to pervade the film's sound, my resistance to the narrative justifying both torture and the murder that it led to had been worn down. That, of course, would be the ultimate goal of the censorship effect. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Yes.
Ideally speaking, on humanitarian grounds, we ought to oppose all torture, whatever form it takes. But I really have two questions. First, you made reference to the enhanced technique used here at McGill University by Dr. Cameron, and it was CIA-sponsored research. And the rationalization offered at the time was that it was a research effort to try to understand the use of these techniques that had been used by the Nazis, by the Soviets, and more specifically by the brainwashing technique used by the North Koreans.
Right.
So some of it was supposedly justified on research grounds.
Right.
The second point, though, perhaps more importantly, comes out of a lunch meeting I had today with some ex-students of mine who happen to be lawyers, and one of whom is particularly interested on the question of torture, and he's usually very reliable, and he reported that he had recently discovered that a new kind of technique, which is putting people in a room that's totally soundproof, so much so that they actually hear their own heartbeats and stomach gurgling, and that within about an hour's time, they become so insane in sound deprivation that they begin gnawing off their own body parts.
Wow.
Now, so the question I ask now is, although ideally we ought to oppose all of these things, are we not dealing with a question of the lesser of two evils? In other words, are we not that I'm trying to justify, but are we better off saying that we ought not to use music torture and go back to the other, more traditional forms of torture, which are even more horrendous. I mean, in terms of practicality, I mean, idealistically speaking, the answer is no. You know, torture is torture, we ought to oppose it. But we don't live in an ideal world. And so, unfortunately, I'm particularly concerned with the misuse of research by academics for political or military purposes. So by pointing out some of these things, are we not sort of feeding the monster?
Ah. Okay. I think I actually hear two questions here, which is that one is about the lesser of two evils, and the other one is that whether the research feeds the monster, the research about the evils themselves. And I guess I think that I want to walk away from the lesser of two evils choice. And I want to do that on a couple of grounds. Actually going back to another remarkable conversation I had at Harvard at a photocopy machine where a graduate student turned to me and said, "Isn't it better than breaking their bones?" And I've quoted that to released detainees, and they say, "No, it's not. It's not better because your bones heal, but your mind could be gone. And the particular man who said, when you're gone, then described the condition of someone who was near him at Guantanamo, who is apparently gone, though biologically living. There is lots of evidence that even the information that eventually led to the U.S.'s elimination of bin Laden was actually not acquired by any of the enhanced interrogation techniques. It was acquired by a human interaction without violence. So I think we don't necessarily have to choose the lesser of two evils between physical and mental torture. On the question of whether we're feeding the monster, whether we do research that feeds the monster, I'm afraid I don't really have a good answer. That's for me, it's another kind of censoring effect. I've become worried that if I, that there's certain kinds of things that I perhaps ought not to say because it would give people ideas. Since it's obvious that the security services are really very up on things. That maybe there is no way to stop them from using our research in violent ways other than a range of arguments that are not primarily scholarly arguments but are moral arguments.
Thank you.
That's the best I can do. So.
I'm surprised at your pessimism about the technology. I'm just very interested to hear what you think is missing if we want to theorize how we would approach this.
Mm.
Just that I would have thought more from people like you on embodiment and the social and political aspects of music. What else are you seeing that's not there?
I guess one thing that I'm seeing that's not there is an actual elaboration of Abate's call for what I want to call a kind of phenomenological musicology. I don't see very much evidence that aspect of her article has actually been followed up on. And I think that's what's wanted is an understanding of the interaction of music as a cultural force that can be weaponized and sound as a physical force that can be weaponized. And I think that the dissolution of music is required to get there, actually. And therefore, the dissolution of musicology as it has been, which has been primarily about the aesthetic forms in which sound comes to us. Yes, sir.
I found your lecture very suggestive, and I was thinking to think about socialization, a very, very basic point. Perhaps it deals with the phenomenology that you're thinking of. The gap between representation and meaning, which is there in the film that you showed us, is something that is experienced differently, often horrifically, by every child growing up, sometimes beautifully by every child growing up. There's the same themes are played with many variations, with almost no variations, with insistence, with one can go on. What you're saying is enormously suggestive, but quite outside the torture chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And, as an aspect of socialization. Mm-hmm. The most fundamental event that you spend your entire life responding to and trying to contextualize.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thanks also very much for the talk. I'd like to maybe go back to the logical question that came up previously. Mm-hmm. And maybe the gap is also between representation and affect.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about this, the Goodman book, for instance. Mm-hmm. You know, the affect of sound, what it does to the body.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it reminded me, as you were playing examples from 0 to 30, of two other, of course, there's a kind of history in cinema doing this, but two other scenes of torture that are very, in film with music, that are very prominent. Of course, one is called Clockwork Orange.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Where in fact Kubrick uses the same oddly enough reverberation effect that they use on the Meow Mix effect, where you hear Singing in the Rain, you know, earlier in the film, and you hear it again, and then of course he distorts it. And, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is the famous scene in Apocalypse Now, playing the Rite of the Blood
Priest. Oh, right, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, over the village, you know, to scare out the.
Mm-hmm. Which is apparently based on a real operation.
Yeah, exactly. And there it's really interesting because those are two examples of how filmmakers are using music to create it as a distancing device,
mm-hmm.
you know, for the audience, of kind of breaking the frame and going, okay, well, this doesn't fit here. You're using Beethoven and you're representing torture on it, or mm-hmm. well, Singing in the Rain, but also actually using
yeah.
Beethoven over the scenes of torture, you know, in
mm-hmm.
or devastation in Europe. But those are historical enough. They play on that historical knowledge of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
But here in this case, you're saying you go beyond the representation of music and into the performance of sound, and the performative
mm-hmm.
act of sound. I think
right.
that's the radical jump you're trying to make
right.
in musicology, which, of course, is centered around textuality still, whether or not
right,
textuality
exactly.
is anchored in social or political frames.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To get at that kind of effective musicology seems to be a quite challenging project, but very interesting.
I completely agree. I personally am not there, but another reason I look forward to sabbatical. But yes, I think that is actually the most, that's what seems to me like the most logical approach to understanding this practice. And my intuition is that if we understand this extreme dark aspect of musicality in contemporary life, we will understand a lot of other things that are not so dark. But that might just be some old modernist habit of mind. Did I see another hand up there?
You mentioned rather strong critiques against both Zero Dark Thirty and SpongeBob for their way of portraying music torture. But are you worried that by criticizing instances of media portraying music torture, you're actually perpetuating an environment in which it's very difficult to portray it in art?
I hadn't thought of that, and so I will now worry about it. I mean, I actually have assumed that there's a kind of practical problem. You don't want to subject people to that. And the only way to make it vivid, to make someone understand what it is to be tortured by sound waves, is to do it to them. That's the kind of aporetic spot that all these filmmakers are in. So
another question? If you could go on with this, you were speaking about the aesthetic dimension. I would also want to speak about the affect, but first of all, just a quick question about the aesthetics, in the sense that I'm not an expert in the history of music, but my sense is that music, in a way, is about creating one of the parts, anyway, of the way that we enjoy music. It's about beauty. It's about It's about having this kind of, these nice affects of being calmed down or energized or whatever. There is this, it's a way that we live with music. Right? Mm-hmm. When it's part of our lives anyway. And I was wondering if that's also part of the efficiency of the torture, in the sense that there's sort of, in a way, I can't say that music is meant to convey beauty, because that would be essentializing it and kind of removing the fact that music and even art, there's always a political dimension to it. It's also about power and all these things. But nevertheless, the fact that this, that experience, which is part of it anyway, about beauty, about nice emotions, even about memory. We remember people we love often through music, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's being tampered with, you know, through the torture, through the enhancement, let's say. And that in fact, it is part of the enhancement to actually take something which in fact is meant, quote unquote, to be beautiful and all that, is now being turned around, and you've been sort of, I would say, robbed from that.
Yes, and in fact, one of the people whose names I can use with impunity, myself, Donald Vance, the American that I mentioned, has commented on how the worst thing for him was when he would hear a song that he liked, because then it would prevent him from resisting, as he spent all his days when he was in his cell at Camp Cropper in Baghdad. Talking to himself so that he wouldn't pay attention to the music, and then he'd hear something he remembered from home, and it would just, as he, in his words, that would then just destroy me, because it brought him back to himself and to a kind of identification with music and pleasure and so on, which was a point of vulnerability for him, and would leave him weeping in his cell. I suppose not everybody in this room would necessarily know that there's a long history of using music as a medium of torture. The current practice by the United States and its allies and pupils is primarily based, as far as I can tell, on manipulating the sheer acoustical violence of it. And secondarily based on stylistic choices intended to prevent entrainment, that is to prevent someone from grooving to music that they like or to music grooving to music that they might not like but that they will eventually kind of keep time to anyway. To disrupt that kind of music, both kinds of musical identification. But the most famous instances are from the Nazi era in Germany and the use of music in concentration camps, which a lot of people are studying now. Not just Shirley Gilbert, whose book Music in the Holocaust came out maybe 5 years ago. But there are Germans and Poles who are doing a lot of archival research about it. And there, the use of music was not primarily about the acoustical violence, but was in part about the production of intrasubjective irony, that people would be forced to play in a string orchestra when they knew that their music was accompanying the selection for the gas chamber. And so the psychological damage of twisting and contorting cathection on beauty was the intended effect. If that makes sense.
No, it doesn't. Oh. It makes sense, but it doesn't make sense.
Well, yeah, it's not a...
Yeah. Okay, so may I ask another question?
Sure.
The affect part, I think, is very interesting, and of course, that's, I guess, what needs to, maybe there's a lot of research that needs to be done in that area. And I was wondering if you have come into contact with, and if you find this useful, it's a question of methodology, but also trying to bring in different disciplines together. Do you feel that for example, primitive signs of labs of, that provide, for example, imagery, brain imagery of the effects of sound on the brain. And do you think that could be useful somehow to that research?
I think it would be extremely useful, and it's one of the few things that I think I can do before I retire and do the things that I really want to do, or that interest me more. I already have put together a collection of books to read about, for instance, neural plasticity, so as to try to understand how music is currently understood to actually change the way the brain operates. I think that's, but I think it goes back to a kind of danger that any research can be used by anyone in a free society, including can be used to violate people. And so there's a kind of, while I think it will illuminate my question, I think it will also illuminate the questions of the CIA and other clandestine services that are not so easily identified.
Yes, I have the last question.
Is there a record of like scores or playlists, the way that the use of this music was actually done, like sets? If there were changes every 15 seconds between songs, what songs were played? I'm sort of curious about if that sort of record exists.
Well, that's a really good question. And I'm sorry to say that I don't have a really good answer. When I first started working on this in 2006, I was trying to compile a playlist of all the songs I couldn't read about or hear about. And eventually I gave up because it was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of songs. And some people would anecdotally say, oh, well, Don Vance, for instance, I heard such and such a song by Nine Inch Nails 5 times a day. I heard Queen, We're the Champions, several times a week. But those are really different songs, right? And talking books have been used, were used in Iraq at some of the forward operating bases. James Taylor was used. I can't find any trace of so-called classical music being used. And I think that's probably because of the way classical music is mixed compared to pop music, that there's a much greater variety of dynamic. That's required for most classical music. Something else I was going to say in response to you.
There's the film Death of the Maiden, which is doing the Schubert.
Right. Thank you. But I was going to say there's actually a film that is not available for distribution in the United States, a film documentary done by a German man that recently won an Emmy in the United States because he made it for German TV, but it's not distributed in the United States, that follows, I think his name is William Cerf, who composed the Barney song for Sesame Street, because that song is used a lot. That's the most frequently mentioned song. And it's the most frequently mentioned song because it was used in seer training, and so everyone who took this practice from his or her seer training had it on his iPod or CD player as, oh, that's what we can use to break people, and it would play over and over again. So what Tristan, I can't remember his last name, what he did in his film was take Cerf around interviewing former interrogators, interviewing a former CIA officer who now consults on how to torture people with music. Right there on screen, Cerf is locked into the garage, like the torture chamber, for a while to experience it. It's a really fascinating documentary.
It's available
in Canada, yeah. Yeah, and it's available from Al Jazeera's website.
What's the title?
Songs of War, I think. Yes, Songs of War.
Good, so we have things to listen to after we'll... Yeah. It's a quick,
small question, but couldn't James Terror, for instance, sue the CIA for that?
Ah, this is a perfect question. There is a group of 56 popular music artists who have filed a Freedom of Information Act request, did it in 2009, hoping to get the information of exactly where their songs were used, thinking that they could sue under the fair use law, although most entertainment lawyers in the United States say that the suit would be thrown out. Because of the way the command structure worked, the choice of repertoire, if you will, is left at the lowest level. So it's not the commander, it's not the Department of Defense signing off on, we're going to torture this guy with music. It's the person in the booth who has Christina Aguilera on his iPod. But actually the second comic video that I played for you, not SpongeBob, but the other one, was made in response to the press releases of that surrounded the filing of the Freedom of Information Act, which was spearheaded by Tom Earle of Rage Against the Machine. The public spokesperson was Roseanne Cash, and there's all kinds of people, including, I think, James Taylor, objecting to the use of their music in this way. They haven't got a response yet.
Thank you very much.